content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the October 1st, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing shows General Milley, one of the top military leaders in the country, seated at a desk. It's kind of stark gray desk, black chair, sort of an examination room or something. He's got a stern look on his face, and in front of him is a locked box. It has a yellow base and a clear plastic top, and you can see inside what looks like a nuclear button. The headline is Hero or Traitor? General Milley's plan to block Trump from nuking China. I believe we get that at our controversy of the week, but we will start with the main stories. FDA panel approves boosters for seniors. What happened? The Food and Drug Administration was poised this week to approve Pfizer boosters for people 65 and over and others at high risk of getting severe COVID after an advisory panel resoundingly rejected President Joe Biden's plan to offer them to most Americans. Last month, Biden announced a plan to offer boosters to every fully vaccinated adult starting on September 20th. Administration officials cited Israeli data showing that the Pfizer shot's effectiveness against infection had dropped sharply over time from 95% to 39%, and that a third shot boosted antibodies and restored 95% protection against the Delta variant. But last week, the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee voted 16-2 against such a plan, concluding after a day of conflicting testimony that there wasn't adequate evidence of a need for third shots for the general population, given data showing the vaccine appears to grant lasting protection from severe illness and death. We don't have the data yet, said infectious disease specialist Ofer Levy. The panel unanimously approved a third shot for Americans over 65, those at high risk of severe COVID, and at-risk workers such as teachers, healthcare workers, and emergency responders. Pfizer unveiled results of a study showing its vaccine is safe and effective in children ages 5 to 11, which could pave the way for pediatric shots within weeks. Johnson & Johnson said late-stage trials show a second dose of its vaccine provided 100% protection against severe COVID and up to 94% efficacy against symptomatic infection. Boosters are expected to extend the duration of protection significantly, said Chief Scientific Officer Paul Stoffels. What the editorial said. The president who vowed to follow the science jumped the gun, said the Miami Herald. By promising boosters to an anxious public while the data was still evolving, he set an artificial deadline that has left many Americans confused and state health officials scrambling to manage expectations. Such confusion and mixed messaging feeds the very distrust in health authorities that's already killing Americans who don't trust vaccines and expert guidance. The evidence for boosters is strong and growing, said the Wall Street Journal. One Israeli study found that the Pfizer vaccine's effectiveness against hospitalization dropped from 91% to 77% after 4 months. Another found a third shot reduced the risk of severe illness 20-fold in those over 60. And many people under 65 whose breakthrough infections don't require hospitalization are still getting severely ill. Why not let people decide for themselves about boosters based on their risk tolerance? What the columnist said. Science prevailed, said infectious disease physician Amesh Adalja in TheHill.com. declining antibodies and some breakthrough infections are expected. That's how vaccines work. Their most important role is to prevent severe disease and death. And with the help of T cells, which remember the virus, they're still doing it brilliantly. Trying to reduce mild infections in the fully vaccinated shouldn't be our focus, especially when poor countries desperately need those doses, said Leslie Bull and Gunisha Kaur in NBCNews.com. To prioritize our own boosters over sharing the wealth is to choose a marginal benefit for the world's rich over the very lives of the world's poor. That's a false choice, said Leanna Nguyen in the Washington Post. The U.S. has millions of doses that'll soon expire and no viable way to get them into arms abroad. So why not allow them to go to vulnerable Americans? That category should include anyone who must work with the public or who has unvaccinated children at home. A growing body of data from Israel suggests waning protection against severe disease over time. We shouldn't wait to heed Israel's lessons. The lack of consensus has left people feeling confused and vulnerable, said Eugene Robinson, also in the Post. After a possible need for boosters was floated, it's hard to accept a final pronouncement that amounts to never mind. An anxious public needs health officials to reach consensus and deliver clear instructions. Yes, I know even if my antibodies wane, I'm still overwhelmingly unlikely to be hospitalized or die from COVID. But even so, the uncertainty and fear I thought I had banished are back. There's a second, shorter main story. Chaos at Haitian migrant camp on U.S.-Mexico border. What happened? The U.S. border crisis reached a new apex this week, symbolized by more than 8,600 mostly Haitian migrants camped in deteriorating conditions under a bridge spanning the Rio Grande. Under fierce criticism, the Biden administration ramped up efforts to expel the migrants, who at one point numbered as many as 14,000, as the mayor of the border city of Del Rio, Texas, pleaded for more border guards. Texas Governor Greg Abbott sent a fleet of police vehicles to form a miles-long barrier, and officers on horseback chased down migrants. One widely featured photo showed an agent swinging his horse's reins as he grabbed a Haitian man by his shirt. By midweek, flights had repatriated more than 1,000 migrants to Haiti, with priority given to deporting unaccompanied adults. But thousands more will likely be allowed to stay in the U.S. The Del Rio standoff exemplifies what has become the biggest migration surge in 20 years. Though the Biden administration granted temporary protected status for the 150,000 Haitians already in the U.S. in May, it has continued to use Title 42, a public health order instituted by Donald Trump to deny asylum seekers entry. Most of the Haitians who have been deported arrived in Del Rio after years of living in South America. They returned to a country largely in shambles after the July assassination of President Jovenel Moise and a deadly 7.2 magnitude August earthquake. Despite this, the Department of Homeland Security warned other Haitians not to make the journey to the U.S. Our borders are not open, DHS official Marcia Espinosa said. What the columnist said, the ugly scenes at Del Rio are a symptom of a Western Hemisphere in crisis, said Sabrina Rodriguez in Politico.com. And the ultimate issues go beyond border security. But they highlight a crisis of confidence in Biden and his incongruous messaging. With progressives fuming about deportations, moderate Democrats demanding to know why deterrence has failed, and Republicans accusing the president of rolling out a welcome mat, there is no political safe harbor for Biden. The Federal Aviation Administration tried to ban Fox News drones from filming the scene in Texas, said Michael Brendan Daugherty in NationalReview.com. The Biden administration would prefer that we not look at what happens when smugglers are given free rein and legal gray zones ruled by human traffickers become an accepted fact of existence. The reality of our porous border may offend liberal sensibilities, but pretending Americans America can shirk the moral burden of enforcing the law is a recipe for disaster, exposing thousands of people to danger, exploitation, and squalor. Getting immigration right isn't easy, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. But Biden's clumsy attempts to fend off right-wing outrage are profoundly disappointing. Giving asylum seekers a chance to have their cases heard is both U.S. law and an international human right. The Haitians who took a do-or-die gamble for a decent life have now found themselves turned into a political football, and Americans are flunking this basic test of our humanity. Controversy of the week. Milley, was he justified in undermining Trump's authority? The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, has some explaining to do, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. Peril, a new book by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa about the final weeks of Donald Trump's presidency, reports that Milley became deeply concerned that Trump was unraveling and might, in a fit of madness or wag-the-dog desperation to stay in power, launch a nuclear attack against China. Milley contacted General Li Zusheng, his counterpart in the Chinese military, to reassure him that there was no attack planned and to promise he'd call back if an attack were imminent. Milley also made senior U.S. military officials in the nuclear chain of command, which he was not to swear an oath to consult with, him first if Trump ordered a launch. If these reports are accurate, said Matthew Walther in the New York Post, Milley is guilty of colluding with a foreign power against the sitting commander-in-chief, or in a word, treason. In our democracy, the armed forces follow the orders of the civilian president. So why does Milley still have his job and the expressed great confidence of now President Biden? In any sane country, Milley would be fired and arrested. Actually, Milley deserves a medal, said Greg Zarroya in USA Today. At the time the four-star general called Lee, Beijing was deeply alarmed by Trump's escalating rhetoric against China and by the January 6th insurrection. Peril reports Chinese intelligence was warning that Trump might attack. With full knowledge of then-Defense Secretary Mark Esper, Milley reached out to Lee with reassurances that may have saved American lives by thwarting a deadly Chinese miscalculation. And can anyone blame the Chinese for worrying what the increasingly deranged Trump might do? Asked Jackie Combs in the Los Angeles Times. The first U.S. president to refuse to abide by the peaceful transfer of power was making it clear he was capable of anything. Milley did the right thing, said Chauncey DeVega in Salon.com, but he should still be fired for it. What made Trump's presidency so damaging was not only his own contempt for the rules and norms of democracy, but also the way he compelled people like Milley to break rules and norms to try to stop him. However noble Milley's intentions, the principle that civilians control the military is a categorical difference between a democracy and a banana republic. I'm glad Milley took the steps he did, said Timothy O'Brien in Bloomberg.com, but his actions only show how dangerous it was for an unstable narcissist like Donald Trump to control the nuclear button. Something is deeply wrong when we have to rely on military leaders going rogue to protect us from rogue presidents. Blame the Republicans, said Leonard Pitts Jr. in the Miami Herald. Milley would not have had to take action if GOP officials had found a molecule of courage and used impeachment or the 25th Amendment to remove a tantrum-throwing, spittle-spewing, reality-denying president whose precarious mental state was on daily public display. The deeper lesson of Millie's intervention, said Tom Nichols in TheAtlantic.com, is that it's remarkably dangerous for any president to have unilateral authority to launch planet-destroying weapons. Congress should address this legacy of the Cold War and put safeguards in place so that no military officer ever again faces a choice between obedience to the Constitution and the fate of human civilization. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for pointed messages. After a box truck emblazoned with "Don't get vaccinated" circled the stadium during the Carolina Panthers home opener with the purported sponsor in smaller letters, Wilmore Funeral Home. A local advertising firm cooked up the stunt to promote vaccinations. It was a good week for centers with the launch of a website providing home delivery of Chick-fil-A chicken sandwiches on Sundays when the Christian-owned fast food franchise is closed. The rewarmed sandwiches purchased on Saturday are priced at $6.66. It was a good week for weed enthusiasts, with new data showing that as the labor shortage deepens, some employers are waiving marijuana drug tests for job candidates. Society has caught up to the reality of smoking marijuana on your own time, said attorney Brittany Robinson. But it was a bad week for a Crimson Tide, with the news that for the first time in state history, including both World Wars and the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, there were more deaths than births last year in COVID-ravaged, vaccine-hesitant Alabama. It was a bad week for exceptions after San Francisco Mayor London Breed was videoed dancing maskless at an indoor nightclub, despite her own citywide mask mandate. Called out for hypocrisy, Breed complained about the fun police and explained, "I was feeling the spirit." It was a bad week for desk duty, with a Washington Post report that some former Taliban fighters miss jihad and are bored by their new roles as Afghanistan's administrators. "Many of my fighters are worried that they missed their chance at martyrdom," said a Taliban commander. And a short and other news piece before we move on. Debt ceiling crisis is looming. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said this week that Republicans would not vote to raise the limit on the federal debt, risking a government shutdown and a financial crisis in the coming weeks. Democrats joined Republicans to raise the debt ceiling during the Trump administration, but McConnell has been emphatic in his rejection, said Senator John Kennedy, Republican from Louisiana. He's not going to change his mind. McConnell and other Senate Republicans cite Democrats' attempts to pass multi-trillion dollar spending bills without Republican votes and want Democrats to own the decision to authorize more debt. A U.S. debt default would have catastrophic consequences, potentially leading to millions of lost jobs and a plunge in the stock market. Briefing this week is titled "The Cost of Long COVID." The mysterious constellation of pervasive symptoms has struck millions, and no one can say how long they'll last. How many people are affected? The CDC and states do not track long COVID cases, so there are no hard numbers. But numerous studies indicate the problem runs deep and wide. A University of Washington study found 30% of people who had COVID were still experiencing symptoms after 6 months. A study by Imperial College London showed almost 15% reported three or more symptoms after 12 weeks. Early research indicates between 10 and 30% of people who get COVID-19 may face long-term issues. More than 42 million Americans are known to have tested positive for COVID, and the real total is undoubtedly much higher. So even at the low-end estimate of 10%, that means millions of people in the U.S. and world are long haulers, facing chronic symptoms that can impair their ability to work, exercise, or lead a normal life. Doctors who treat long COVID patients say the cost of both of their future care and lost productivity could be staggering. "I don't think anyone truly understands the magnitude of this," said Denise Lutch-Mangsing, who oversees the post-COVID-19 recovery program at Yale New Haven Hospital. "The majority of my patients are in the prime of their work lives, and they're debilitated." What are the symptoms of long COVID? Literally hundreds of symptoms have been reported. Among the most common are nerve and muscle pain, persistent fatigue, breathing difficulties, heart palpitations, loss of smell and taste, and gastrointestinal distress. Issues plaguing post-COVID patients range from impaired metabolic function and kidney damage to blood clotting problems and menstrual changes. "The virus can affect nearly every organ system," said Ziad Al-Ali, who studies long-haul patients in the Department of Veterans Affairs Health System. Then there are neurological symptoms, which can be the most debilitating. They include sleep disorders, dizziness, numbness in the limbs, anxiety, and brain fog marked by confusion, memory loss, and inability to concentrate. "The worst cases really look like dementia," said Jurdis Fromhold, leader of a German study on long COVID, who cites patients as young as 18 who can't form sentences. Cassandra Hernandez, a 38-year-old nurse in San Antonio, went from working on her master's degree to forgetting how to use a fork and struggling to read at fifth grade level. "It's embarrassing," she said. What causes these problems? There are several leading theories. One is that they're caused by fragments or reserves of the virus that linger in the body. Another possible cause is the persistent inflammation or damage wrought by the initial infection, affecting blood vessels, nerve pathways, or other areas of the body. The dominant theory is that long COVID is an autoimmune disease triggered by infection by an unfamiliar virus, in which victims' revved up immune systems continue to attack healthy tissue after the initial infection is gone. Or it could be a combination of these factors. Whatever the cause, long COVID mirrors other mysterious chronic illnesses triggered by viral and bacterial infections. Among them is myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, MECFS, cases of which have been linked to outbreaks of SARS, Ebola, and other viruses. There are no known markers for who will develop long COVID, which affects many people with no previous health issues, and many whose initial infections were mild or asymptomatic. Do long COVID patients improve? The range is broad. Some patients largely return to their old selves within 3 or 4 months. Many show meaningful improvement but have lingering issues. But some remain significantly impaired after a year or more and struggle to hold jobs. A lot of us can't afford our medications or groceries, and quite a few of us are going homeless, said Amanda Finley, a Kansas City archaeologist who founded a Facebook discussion group for long haulers after suffering persistent symptoms including brain fog, heart palpitations, fatigue, and shortness of breath. Treatment generally involves managing symptoms through physical therapy, cognitive exercises, and other treatments. "It's a long process, and people need to make a lot of behavioral and life adjustments," said David Putrino, a rehabilitation specialist who treats long COVID patients at New York's Mount Sinai Hospital. What can be done? In February, the National Institutes of Health launched a $1.2 billion initiative to study the causes and treatment of long COVID. The American Medical Association and CDC have launched initiatives to educate doctors about identifying and treating the disorder. And across the country, Hospitals have established dozens of integrated clinics dedicated to long COVID, where specialists in various areas are studying the syndrome and refining treatments. Our clinical model is constantly evolving as we learn more from our patients, said Yale's Lutch Mangsing. Experts warn that we've only begun to reckon with the social and financial cost. We're going to need resources for many years to come to deal with these patients, said Putrino. Time for a few of the best columns. We'll start with two from the U.S. Steve Chapman at the Chicago Tribune writes, "The Partisan Addiction to Gerrymandering." Many state lawmakers are now scheming to make elections an empty formality, said Steve Chapman. Every 10 years, congressional districts are redrawn, enabling the dominant party in states to gerrymander their way to a chokehold on power. A recent study found that after 2011's round of redistricting, 45 states were severely gerrymandered, with 43 of them redrawn to favor the GOP. That allowed for continued Republican state-level control even after Republicans lost the statewide popular vote in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin in 2018. Democrats complain but engage in the same thing. Gerrymandering has let Illinois Democrats control the state house for all but two of the past 38 years. And in New York, Democrats now plan to use extreme gerrymandering to reduce Republican-held congressional seats from 8 to 4 or 3 of the 26 that the state will have, hoping this maneuver will keep the house in their party's control. A fairer system would use independent commissions to draw up fairly geometrical districts, forcing both parties to compete for voters with their ideas rather than drawing lines to make them moot. Democracy is supposed to rest on the consent of the governed, not the governors. The myth of nonpartisan justices. If Supreme Court justices don't like being called partisan hacks, said Erwin Kamerinsky, they should not act like them. Justice Amy Coney Barrett last week took aim at critics who complain about the politicization of the court, insisting that judicial philosophies are not the same as political parties. Barrett made her claim of nonpartisan neutrality while speaking at an event honoring Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who blocked a Democratic nominee, Merrick Garland, from occupying a vacant Supreme Court seat, and later rushed through her confirmation. Barrett likes to portray herself as an originalist, dedicated to a strict reading of the Constitution, but many decisions by the court's activist conservative majority cannot possibly be defended on originalist grounds. Conservatives threw out campaign finance limits passed by Congress, creating a right for corporations to spend unlimited amounts in election campaigns. Corporations and campaign spending aren't in the Constitution. Republican-appointed justices also gutted the Voting Rights Act by creating new limits on the law's reach that are nowhere mentioned in it. Everyone knows that Supreme Court decisions always have been and always will be a product of the ideology of the justices. Why pretend otherwise? This is an international column from Russia. Tech giants won't stand up for democracy. The Kremlin has a new ally in its battle against democracy, said Kirill Martinov, American tech firms. In the run-up to last week's parliamentary elections, many Russians had planned to use the smart voting protest strategy promoted by jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The goal was to inflict as many losses as possible on the ruling United Russia Party by having all opposition voters back the same candidate in a given district, no matter whether that candidate was a communist or ultranationalist or liberal Democrat. But just days before the first ballots were cast, Apple and Google yanked an app from their stores that had been designed to coordinate protest votes. The Kremlin had threatened the company's Russia-based employees with prosecution, but Google and Apple should have stood firm. Having begun feeding the crocodile from their hands, these corporations will gradually allow themselves to be devoured. We had hoped that one of our tech entrepreneurs, Pavel Durov, the St. Petersburg-born inventor of the Telegram Messenger app, would prove more resilient. So when Telegram blocked its smart vote bot, it wounded many Russian users to the very heart. Still, Durov fled Russia in 2014. From now on, resistance must come from within our borders. It's time for the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, A Land Rush in Peoria. Drawn by too low to believe house prices, buyers from around the U.S. have descended on the Midwest, said journalist Greg Jaffe in the Washington Post. Their high hopes are meeting a disappointing reality. A block that had once been home to more than 100 people was down to six who lived amid the ruins of another era. There were gaping holes in roofs and crumbling foundations. Some houses were so bad that even the squatters had quit on them, and now only raccoons and rodents sought them out for shelter. And then, for reasons that no one in Peoria, Illinois could fathom, people from all over America began snapping them up. By early summer, seven houses on this block of Peoria's West Lincoln Avenue had sold to buyers from Los Angeles, San Diego, Long Island, New York, Tacoma, Washington, and other far-off places. Among them was Javon Michael Culver, a barber in Salt Lake City, where in the waning days of the pandemic, the median price of a single-family home had raced past $515,000. Far more than Culver could ever afford to spend. With a few frenzied clicks and emails, he had grabbed 2011 West Lincoln Avenue for $4,500, sight unseen. First house I ever bought in my life, said Culver, 36. Most of the buyers had acquired their homes through online auctions. None had actually ever been to Peoria, nor did they have any plans to move there. And yet they bid by the dozens, if not hundreds, on homes throughout Peoria's dying South End, drawn by the desire to own property, an essential piece of the American dream that had eluded them in the places where they lived and seemed to grow more distant with each passing month. Somehow they had found a version of that dream online and in a place called Peoria that seemed almost as good. I felt like I finally found a cheat code, Culver said. Now he was the owner of a house in a city that he had until recently never heard of, on a block whose ever-dwindling numbers, including a 20-year-old named Benny Cook. In the spring, amid the buying frenzy, Cook and his fiancée had rented one of the block's last habitable homes and cleaned out the soiled clothes and spoiled food left by the homeless people who had been staying there. For protection from the addicts who sought shelter in the block's abandoned houses, Cook bought a guard dog, security cameras, and an AR-15 rifle. If you ain't scared to go in an abandoned house at night, you ain't scared to do something to me, he said. It was the first place Cook could call his own, and a place where he and his fiancée hoped to start a family. I can make it our dream house, he said. Some 1,500 miles away in Utah, Culver was starting to make plans, too. For his first trip to Peoria, and for the house and land he believed might someday change his life. The story of West Lincoln Avenue's bizarre summer land rush starts with the deindustrialization of the Rust Belt, which had hollowed out Peoria's once thriving South End. It spans decades of growing inequality, which had turned America into a place of winners and losers, with less and less in between. The trigger, though, was the pandemic, the recession, and the recovery. In much of the country this spring, low interest rates, bidding wars, and pent-up demand had sparked a real estate boom. In California, the median single-family home price hit a record $818,260, up nearly 40% since the start of the pandemic. Utah prices surged 30% during the same period. By June, economists were using words like unprecedented to describe the rise, and speculating that in some markets the dream of home ownership might be forever out of reach for most middle-class Americans. Peoria had the opposite problem, hundreds of decaying homes that it couldn't afford to demolish. In 2020, pandemic-related budget cuts had forced the city to suspend all non-emergency teardowns. Many of these abandoned houses were funneled to the county's tax foreclosure auction, which that September included 190 properties, more than double the previous years. On the ground in Peoria, these homes were worthless. Online, though, they had value. A 31-year-old investor from Texas bid $751, $1 over the minimum, on virtually every property in the auction and walked away with 54 of them. He sold 43 to an investor in Sarasota for about $1,400 each. The Sarasota investor put a few of the homes on bidforassets.com, an online auction site, each week this spring and early this summer. Great opportunity, his pitches usually began. Lower down, a disclaimer cautioned, in rare cases, houses might be demolished or burned down. Most of the houses sold for $3,000 to $6,000. Ross Black, the city's community development director, likened the investors who bought houses in bulk to vultures trying to extract the last bit of value from a dying place. They had almost no incentive to sink a penny into the homes before they flipped them, usually for a small profit. Black had more sympathy, he said, for the unfortunate buyers bidding for them online. In early May, he pressed play on his office phone, where a woman from Stockton, California, had left him a voicemail message. "I am a new property owner in Peoria. I can never say it," she began. "There has been a huge misunderstanding." Soon, Black was pulling up in front of the woman's Peoria house, which was boarded up and missing most of its roof. Weeds were growing in the bathroom sink, all of which led Black to ask the question that he had been pondering for weeks. How does someone in Boston or Salt Lake City or Los Angeles end up buying a home in Peoria that they've never even seen? There were so many ways to answer that question on West Lincoln Avenue. For Culver, the barber from Utah, the answer to the question could begin in Little Rock, California, a threadbare desert town outside Los Angeles, where he was raised by his grandmother, who owned a few rental units that she had sold when Culver was still a child. "When I was a kid, it seemed like all the old folks owned property," he said. "I didn't want that to die with me." Or it could begin in Salt Lake City, where he worked as a barber and had scraped together enough cash to finance a 2016 Porsche SUV and buy a 1988 Chevy Caprice. To Culver, property was the most ultimate thing you could own, and the one big thing that always seemed beyond his means. Until a day in March, when he was scrolling through his Instagram feed, up popped a video of a 19-year-old who was talking about buying and selling homes with little to no money. He began Googling, and after a few clicks landed on bidforassets.com, where much of America seemed to be within his grasp. Empty lots in Arkansas and New Mexico were going for $800. Rundown houses in West Virginia and Pennsylvania were selling for a few thousand. Even neo-Gothic church in Illinois was up for grabs. "It was overwhelming," said Culver, of the rush he felt as he took in the possibilities. And soon he had bid on more than a dozen properties. Most of the auctions ran for a week, with bids starting at $1 and rising in $50 or $100 increments. Culver's first win was a plot of land in Arkansas he snagged for $800. He won a commercial building in Dallas City, Illinois, for which he was the only bidder. A few small pieces of land somewhere in New Mexico, and an empty lot on West Lincoln Avenue that the Sarasota investor had put up for bid. The investor offered to sell him an adjacent house on West Lincoln for $6,500. Then the investor cut the price by $2,000, and suddenly Culver decided he couldn't afford to wait. "I'd never seen a house for $4,500," he said. Slowly, over the course of the summer, the distant buyers made their ways to Peoria to check on their homes. Malkibu Moore, a long-haul trucker from Philadelphia, pushed open the unlocked door to his house on West Millman Street and stepped over piles of rotting food, used condoms, and feces smeared across the floor and walls. Minutes later, he was back on the sidewalk catching his breath when a prostitute propositioned him. "How are you?" Moore asked. "Drunk," she said. "What are you selling?" "I'm not selling," Moore replied. "I'm buying. I bought that house. I'm going to fix it up." But by that point, Moore knew the structure wasn't worth rehabilitating. A few days later, city officials found a dead body inside. Two blocks south, the West Lincoln Avenue buyers weren't faring any better. The owner of a 1915 West Lincoln, a former union representative from Los Angeles, she said she wanted to punch somebody in the face after seeing her home in person. She tried calling contractors. "Because of the neighborhood, nobody wants to work here," she said. Culver had exhausted his savings to buy his Peoria properties, and by mid-July was still short on the money to make the trip to see them. "I know I really need to go," he said. In pictures online, he had noticed a crack that ran the length of his house where the siding met the foundation, and he had begun researching alternatives in case the structure was too rotted to repair. For motivation, Culver liked to go for drives through some of Salt Lake City's most upscale neighborhoods, where homes sold for more than $1 million. He turned into a neighborhood just down the road from the elementary school where his daughter worked as a part-time custodian. "Look at this one," Culver said, as a sprawling two-story compound emerged through a gap in 9-foot hedges. "It wraps around the entire block." Because Culver was a mobile barber and cut people's hair in their homes rather than in a salon, his business hadn't taken a huge hit during the pandemic. He typically made $75 to $100 a haircut with tip. He liked the way the right haircut could restore a person's self-confidence and the way his best customers treated him as an old friend. Lately, though, that hadn't seemed good enough. Culver thought about the movie The Founder, which chronicles the rise of Ray Kroc and McDonald's. In a pivotal scene, Kroc realizes that the real money in his business doesn't come from selling food, but rather from land the company leases to franchisees. "You're not in the burger business," Kroc's chief financial officer tells him. "You're in the real estate business." Culver also thought about his ancestors, freed slaves who had been promised but never given 40 acres and a mule as reparations. How might his life be different if that promise had been kept? "If you have to work for every dollar that you make, then you're not making it," he said. "If I have to physically get up and go to work for my next meal, then I am getting by, but I am not living." There were many visions of how the summer land rush might end in West Lincoln Avenue. Peoria officials were sure that it would turn out badly for everyone. Some of the new homeowners would flip their properties and perhaps extract a little bit more money from an already broken place. Those who couldn't find a buyer would become overwhelmed by the amount of work required to fix their homes and stop paying taxes, triggering yet another tax foreclosure in 3 years. The houses would return to auction in slightly worse shape, a process that would repeat itself until the structures were beyond any hope of repair. "It's very frustrating," said Black, the Peoria development official. "Every month these properties take a step closer to demolition and a step further from someone being able to renovate them." Meanwhile, a new crop of more than 650 properties, including 7 houses and empty lots on the same block where Culver's house sat and where Cook was living, were headed to the tax foreclosure auction. It was by far the biggest auction Black could remember in 29 years of working for the city. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Couple of short pieces from the Health and Science page. How wildfires fuel ocean algae blooms. 2 years ago, a massive algae bloom swelled in the southern Pacific Ocean, growing over 4 months to cover an area larger than Australia. Such blooms are often caused by agricultural runoff, which is loaded with the nitrogen that these tiny plant-like organisms love to feed on. But there are no farms in this remote stretch of the water between New Zealand and South America. Instead, a new study has found that the bloom was caused by a natural disaster thousands of miles away to the west, the wildfires in Australia in 2019 and 2020. Those blazes consumed an area of forest larger than West Virginia and sent plumes of smoke 20 miles into the air. The ash and smoke that blew out to sea contained trace amounts of iron, which algae need to live and reproduce, and which is comparatively scarce in the southern Pacific. Using satellite images, the researchers found that the blooms peaked in places where large amounts of soot landed. At sea, algae can poison other organisms by releasing toxins that can suffocate marine life by sucking up oxygen as they decompose. But algae also absorb carbon from the atmosphere, and the researchers say the blooms were so massive that they might have soaked up 50 to 150% of the carbon released by the Australian wildfires. The holy grail is, how much did it offset? Study co-author Nicholas Kasser from Duke University tells Popular Science. But we don't know. How whales learn their tunes. Humpback whales are famous for their songs, but while the males in the southern hemisphere develop new tunes every year, their counterparts in the northern Atlantic stick to classics that only gradually evolve. Now researchers from the University of London think they have worked out why, reports The Guardian. It seems that the northern whales, whose movements are confined by the continents on either side, tend to be funneled into the same area during their feeding season. The males interact and pass around the tweaks to their songs, so they end up singing the same tune, which changes only gradually over the years. By contrast, the southern whales, being more spread out, do not meet in feeding season and only interact with neighboring populations. Instead of all working on the same song, each group learns the song of its westerly neighbor, and the music is slowly spread eastward. Eventually, the music may come full circle, but by then, it will have accumulated so many changes, it will effectively be a different song. We'll flip over to the Talking Points page. Kabul drone strike, a horrible mistake. How could one of the final U.S. military actions in Afghanistan last month have gone so spectacularly wrong, asked Daniel Rothenberg in CNN.com. In the midst of our chaotic withdrawal from Kabul, military leaders said they executed a righteous drone strike, supposedly killing a suspected ISIS-K suicide bomber days after terrorists killed more than 173 people at Kabul's airport. Last week, however, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin acknowledged a horrible mistake. The target, Zamirai Ahmadi, 43, was actually a longtime aid worker for a California-based charity who filled his car with water canisters that aerial observers mistook for bombs. His surviving family is now grappling with American-made hell, said Sudarshan Raghavan in the Washington Post. The missile attack obliterated Ahmadi and nine relatives, seven of them children. Two adults witnessed their own kids' deaths. They have constant nightmares, said Amadi's brother, Emil, and often wake up screaming. This does not bode well for President Biden's over-the-horizon counterterrorism strategy, said former Army and CIA officer Kevin Carroll in the Wall Street Journal. Biden defended his Afghanistan troop withdrawal by touting the military's and CIA's ability to use aerial surveillance and unmanned drones to monitor and kill terrorists from afar. But despite popular illusion that military leaders receive accurate, timely, and granular intelligence at a keystroke, officers often must rely on incomplete information, impaired by factors as basic as bad weather or low fuel. When we had human intelligence on the ground in Afghanistan, computers and phones could be raided. Tactical imagery and signals intelligence could identify targets' faces, vehicles, and voices. But U.S. drone operators are now flying blind in Afghanistan, and more civilian casualties are inevitable. American presidents like to believe that with armed drones, wars can be won on the cheap, said Sarah Krebs and Paul Lushenko in WashingtonPost.com. But the ease with which a distant operator can erase human beings creates a moral hazard and can lead to mistakes like the one in Kabul. A counterterrorism strategy relying on promiscuous drone strikes is likely to backfire, said W. James Antle III in TheWeek.com. When we inevitably kill civilians, family members are radicalized. We must ask whether we are killing more terrorists than we are creating. Taxes. Is the Democrats' plan fair? When a Democrat is elected president, new taxes become inevitable, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Sure enough, the House Ways and Means Committee last week released a series of tax proposals intended to fund President Biden's jaw-dropping multi-trillion-dollar spending goals. The top individual tax rate would increase from 37 to 39.6%, the capital gains rate from 20 to 25%, and the corporate tax rate for big companies from 21% to 26.5%. On top of that, there would be a 3% surtax for people earning more than $5 million. The goal of these tax hikes, which supposedly would raise $2.2 trillion over 10 years, is to fund a European-style welfare state. But that's just magical thinking. To fund cradle-to-grave benefits, Europe heavily taxes the middle class at rates over 50%. Biden claims that households making less than $400,000 a year will remain unscathed, said Charlie Dent in CNN.com. Down here on planet Earth, costs from raising corporate taxes inevitably flow down to workers and consumers. There's nothing radical about the House's proposal, said Paul Waldman and Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Republicans massively slashed the top corporate tax rate in 2017 from 35% to 21%, and Democrats are only proposing to nudge it up to 26.5%. The top personal income tax would rise from 37 to 39.6%, but in 1980, it was 70%. Unfortunately, however, the plan targets the merely rich rather than the plutocrats, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Billionaires game the tax code by amassing wealth in ways that generate very little taxable income for them or their heirs. The House committee's plan doesn't close loopholes for estate taxes and carried interest, which benefit hedge fund and private equity billionaires. What a spineless cop-out. Fiscal irresponsibility and subservience to big money donors are bipartisan vices, said Chris Tomlinson in the Houston Chronicle. Republicans carp about wasteful spending when they're out of power, Democrats about letting the wealthy off the hook. Under the House proposal, America's top 10% of earners will pay more, but Democrats aren't truly leveling the playing field. The rich will be free to amass intergenerational wealth, and income inequality will continue to grow. In Washington, rich people finance elections to escape taxation, and both parties deliver. Got time for a few short notes. U.S. COVID deaths have reached 675,000, surpassing the official death toll for the 1918-19 flu pandemic in the U.S. One in 500 Americans has died from COVID. The daycare industry is down 126,700 workers from pre-pandemic levels, a decline of more than 10%. The shortage of workers, who typically are paid about $12 an hour, less than Dunkin' Donuts pays, has closed some child care centers and after-school programs at a time when many parents of young children are trying to return to work. Two-thirds of the total acreage of giant sequoias in California's Sierra Nevada burned down between 2015 and 2020, according to the National Park Service. Last week, firefighters started wrapping many remaining trees in flame retardant foil, including the 2,300-year-old General Sherman tree, which is 275 feet tall and 36 feet in diameter. And we'll finish the show with a quote from Ian McEwan, who says, "Hesitation is a crucial element of creation. If people would rephrase writer's block as hesitation, writers would feel better about it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.